I was just thinking about your barrel maker. And in Heidegger's kind of, you know, again, personal commitment to the traditions and to the kind of the country sort of like living and all that stuff. And how, you know, seeing somebody kind of making a barrel or being involved in making a barrel is at the heart of the phenomenological experience. And Heidegger talks about, I mean, he tries to explain this because he talks about things that are what he calls present to hand. So things that are present to hand, they have a simple existence in the world. And in a sense, I suppose the easiest way to put this is these are the things that science catalogues. So presence in the world. And he doesn't think this has anything to do, really, when you really kind of strip it back, I don't think he thinks this has anything to do with being. It's nothing to do with Dasein. It's a way of cataloguing the world. So you can have this glass, and I can say this glass is this size, this circumference, and it has this capacity. And abstractly, I can define this glass. And I think, in much the same with Husserl, I think Heidegger is saying that present to hand identification of something is trivial. It's nothing to do with Dasein. It's nothing to do with existence in the situation. What he's more interested in is what he calls ready to hand. And ready to hand is when you actually take the thing in your own hand and it becomes part of your lived experience. So once I've picked up this glass, then it becomes, it becomes part of my world, not just an abstraction of something kind of lined up in a catalogue somewhere. This is part of my world. It's got the drink in it that I've chosen. I chose that drink because of my relation, because where I grew up and my relationship with my family and where my mum took me for dinner. And this glass then reminds me of my mum. This glass, I could think about where I bought it from. And there's a whole bunch of stuff that suddenly just adheres to this glass once it becomes part of you. And the phenomenologists love that. There's a lot of talk about that. Even post-critical thinkers talk about it. It's people like Michael Polanyi, who has sort of some phenomenological kind of, you know, flavour to him, but he'd rather call himself post-critical, makes the same point, the idea of that we inhabit our tools. That when you take on a tool, when you take on an object, it becomes part of you. I think we've talked about this before. You know, you get into a car, and you're not aware of being in a car, and you're not aware of, you know, turning the steering wheel and control. It just becomes intuitive. It becomes a peripheral focus. As soon as it becomes, once it becomes, what's the word he uses? Once it becomes the primary focus, then it starts just becoming a thing in the a thing to be catalogued, and you don't do it properly anymore. It's not part of your existence.
Of course, Wittgenstein. We can strip this right back. Strip this right back to
do it.
Not even words, numbers. He talks about, you know, mathematics is just ontology. It doesn't tell us anything about the world. It just presents this way of looking at the world, and it's up to us to use. When we use mathematics, it becomes something. We can't explain anymore. So language brings a mirror up to the world, but there's a jump between the world and language.
Only us.
That's the limit. That's the limit for Wittgenstein. You can't go further than, you can just, till you're blue in the face trying to explain what a word means, or what, trying to teach mathematics to children or whatever. It's up to the children to make the leap to understand what it is.
Yes. And interesting enough, I mean, that's at the heart of if our listener will recall our conversation about Søren Kierkegaard, who in many ways is, he is, if not the actual founding father of phenomenology, because I think he had an actual more traditional ontology in mind. But he was certainly the originator of existentialism, prior to Heidegger and prior to Sartre and so on. And he makes, he makes exactly the same point from a religious perspective. You can't convince anybody through clever argument about the existence of God any more than you can convince somebody that you love them. Ultimately, it's down to this that kind of act of faith, that sort of leap of faith. And Heidegger's saying this, you know, this, the whole, you know, that existence only becomes true existence, authentic existence, part of Dasein, being here, when it's existence for me. It's present to hand. You take something in your hand, you incorporate something, an object or an idea or a person, and they become part of your world, your existential world. And that's being. That's being, not just kind of cataloguing, abstract objects as we find them in the world. So he's quite keen on that. He says, even if something doesn't work, even say, for example, so I picked up this glass and it was empty, so it didn't have a drink in it that I wanted. Or I pick up this glass and it slips out of my hand and I drop it. Heidegger says he calls that unready to hand. So it's still because it's kind of something that should be ready to hand, but it's failing in its purpose. But even though it's failing in its purpose, it still teaches us something about its existence. It's still something that's part of us. So even when something fails, if I drop this glass, it's still a broken glass, which should have had a drink in it for me, and it would have had that drink in it for me. So all of that is still part of the failure of it. And I think that's quite nice, the idea that even our failed engagement with things are not failures in an inauthentic sense. These are just, you know, this is just, you know, we're still learning about our existence, still learning about our place in the world through these things. And it could be like a job. You know, I'm doing a job. And your job could be the thing that, you know, is ready to hand. It's not something you're watching somebody else do. You're not just reading the job description. You're actually in there doing the job. And that becomes part of your existence, and it has a unique phenomenological existence. Now, if it all goes pear-shaped, and you make a mess of it, it's still part of Dasein. It's still part of your existence. You still learn from it. It's still a valuable, authentic thing to have done, even though it somehow was a broken thing which didn't do what you hoped it would do. But that's not a bad thing. That's just, you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing. What is bad is when you put everything at a distance. And make it present to hand, just as something to look at. You're spectating, in a way. It's that spectating thing.
Not taking part.
Yeah, you're spectating, and as soon as you spectate and you don't take to hand, then you are much more likely to be influenced by the chatter, the they, that background of kind of herd noise, which is just going to push you in a direction, you know?
Well, sounds very prescient.
I think so. I quite like Heidegger for that, I have to say. I quite like Heidegger for that.
Yeah, okay. He's very out of his time in many ways.
I mean, he's got a very mixed reception as Heidegger. I mean, he does not write clearly. He's not an easy bloke to read.
I've not actually read him. Is it like Husserl with like a obviously Dasein, but does he bring another load of new words?
Oh yeah, yeah. He does that German thing where he just attaches and, you know, just attaches a whole bunch of words together to try and kind of make a point. And I think, as we said previously, these people were struggling for a vocabulary to talk about something which they felt hadn't actually been talked about. So it's not surprising. But some people, I mean, clearly you can imagine the more kind of, you know, Anglo-Saxon sort of, you know, philosophical traditions, just think this is all just nonsense on stilts, and, you know, the guy was a total fake. Other people just say, well, he's just coming up with kind of homespun, like, country wisdom, like, you know, better to get stuck in, you know, get your hands dirty, that's existence for you. But he just says it in a very complicated way.
There is that thing, it's a kind of a wake-up call. So I'm going to refer to Wittgenstein once more here.
Please.
When you read Wittgenstein, he makes a point of saying that nothing is hidden. And what he means by that is, there is a danger when you go down to some of these philosophical routes. It gets all kind of mystical in the sense, one day we're going to find, we're going to encounter the truth, and it's something that we can't quite see. It's just around the corner, and Wittgenstein said, "No, that's nonsense.
Yeah,
nothing is hidden, and you can't just keep inventing new ways to say the same thing. Essentially, that's why the Tractatus is a stripped back as far as you can go to the bone, simplest thing." Which obviously it makes it quite difficult to read in that way. But it's fundamentally the opposite. That's why you have that. You know, the analytic is a different way to approach.
I mean, it's your man Jean-Paul, who we've mentioned before, was very keen on both Husserl and Heidegger. I mean, he takes issue with Heidegger on some points, but in many ways he is following a similar kind of trajectory. He starts in a similar kind of place.
Hang on, just stop there a second. If we're talking about Sartre, I've just got to put my beret on.
Yeah. Oh, that is very natty.
And was it? How do you pronounce it? The French
Gouas.
Gouas. Okay.
Yeah.
I got my coffee.
Yeah.
Got my polar neck. Okay. Yeah. Let's go.
What was I keep thinking of, there was a film with Tony, I think it was Tony Hancock,
The Rebel,
that's right. Yeah. And he ends up, you know, he wants to be an artist and he's not, or maybe he is, I don't know, but he ends up in Paris, doesn't he?
Yes,
or somewhere,
and
he just adopts that whole kind of uniform. He's there, kind of doing sculpture and painting. He's got the beret on and the black, and that uniform. I've never really. We both tend to kind of rock the noir, in our wardrobe. But beret, I draw the line. What about you?
I don't wear a beret, of course. Yeah. Unless it's the raspberry beret.
Oh, man.
I'll go film noir.
I will wear like a fedora once in a while.
Yeah,
it's very poncy, it's very pretentious. But just now and again, you just have to rock one and just think, let's just like see if I can carry this off.
You've got to try to carry it off. Joking aside, I'm half joking here, but I do think about Sartre. You really get into kind of Sartre's style.
Yeah.
This is the philosophy for the people.
And his
philosophy itself is very potent. Mm. One commentator described it as like champagne.
It's like wouldn't he?
Exciting.
Yeah.
Kind of philosophy you can get behind.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, if ever you were going to identify a stereotype. I mean, we started our podcast way back in the day. You know, what does a philosopher look like? What is a philosopher? If you were looking for a stereotype, you've got two moments, haven't you? You've got the Greeks, so lots of kind of togas and sandals. And then you've got the kind of the banks of the Seine, Café Society, you know, Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir and all these people kind of, you know, sitting around sipping coffee and cognac. And chatting philosophy and revolution. If you had a choice, which of these two milieu would you have liked to operate in?
If I was living in Greece, maybe I'd wear the toga. A bit too cold around here for that. But is Sartre up there on the Mount Rushmore? Philosophical Mount Rushmore.
Oh, I think so. Didn't you?
It just occurred to me because we haven't continued that.
Yeah, I think he probably ought to be. I think he's the guy who brings. I think he brings that kind of phenomenological project into cultural focus, and he takes it to the streets. I mean, he obviously got very kind of Marxist towards the second part of his life, which is understandable. And we'll talk about this in a bit. Sometimes, you know, you think to yourself, okay, you've got that image of the kind of the ascetic kind of philosopher, the guy in the toga, the kind of the dialogical philosopher, preaching in the streets, telling people how it is, living in a bin somewhere, and being all kind of, you know, and not and being misunderstood in the time. And then you've got the kind of philosopher rock star of the of that French period in the 60s. I'm not going to lie to you. That's the one that suits my image best. I mean, I prefer that. Yeah. It's clearly, I mean, it's how we rolled, you know, when you were a student back in the day. We spent a lot of time just sat by the Thames.
Yeah.
You know.
In the cafes with the people.
Yeah, with the people. We weren't drinking cognac so much, but, you know, getting a few beers down. We're talking about Sartre. Yeah, I mean, he was quite a fan. I mean, he's... You know, we had Heidegger talking about kind of being in time, and his famous, you know, text of being in time, which is only the kind of first bit of a much bigger project, which he never quite finished. Sartre's book is a kind of a nod to that, and a kind of a kind of acknowledgement that he's on the same sort of train. Is being in nothingness, which sounds like the ultimate title for any philosophical piece. If you think about it, I mean, being in nothingness just sounds like a philosophical piece, doesn't it?
Yeah,
really?
Yeah.
It's like when Heidegger and someone's talking, and the phenomenologists start talking about the being of being, and you start to my great shame, I understand what they're talking about, but it's exactly that sort of language that makes people go, "Oh, yeah, right."
I don't think you should be to your shame. I remember trying to read that book. Yeah. And I got like halfway through the first chapter, I think this is making my head hurt.
Yeah.
This is being the being of being.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah. And was it that Annie Hall says, or something has a genuine negative capability? What do you mean? Negative capability? What the hell is that supposed to mean? This is the kind of language. Obviously, they're parodies. This is the kind of language. But I mean, but Sartre was very much trying to refine, I think, what kind of Heidegger and Husserl had been talking about, and the famous battle cry, the famous kind of Sartrean battle cry, was as I'm sure many of our listeners will know, is existence precedes essence. Existence precedes essence, and it boils down to the same point that both Husserl and Heidegger are making, that it's your actual, real, lived physical existence in the world that defines your existence, which is actually being. If we're going to talk about ontology at all, and ontology is just the science, the philosophical science of understanding how things are, how things exist, then it's your existence in the world, and how you kind of embody things and how you experience that. That's what it's all about. Essence is a secondary thing. Essence is something you figure out after you've had the experience. As Husserl said previously, you don't start off with an idea about what something is and then try and make your experience of it fit with that model. Because we do that all the time. We try and change the facts to fit our prejudgments. So Doctor Who said that, by the way. The stupid and the powerful have one thing in common. They both try and make facts fit with their beliefs rather than develop their beliefs out of their experience. Sartre says this is the thing. It's no good having that kind of, almost that kind of Platonic metaphysic where we've already got laid out these categories of, this is what a human being is, this is what a cat and a dog is, glasses, we'll go through the whole lot. And then whenever we see something like that in the world, we force that experience into that cubbyhole and say, you know, even if it doesn't fit, even if there are things that don't look right, you're still trying to force it in.
It's kind of, this is where it's so, I said before, as a philosophy, it's like champagne. It's very exciting. So if you Existentialism is a Humanism, which is the best book ever because it's really, really thin.
Yeah. And genuinely a good place to start.
It's an amazing read. It's an amazing read.
Sartre, yeah.
Yeah, he says that he talks about, in the past, we had this predetermination. Mm. So he gives the example of a pen knife. If you look at a pen knife, it had a designer, someone carefully maybe drew what it was going to be, and it was created, and it had and the designer had a plan for it in mind, and then it became the pen knife. But for us, because now God is dead, remember.
Yeah, that's Vanessa's fault, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Vanessa. Yeah. She did it.
Yeah.
There is no excuse. You can't say, I'm an English man, middle-aged man, English man, and then that means this X, Y, and Z. Yeah. I have to follow this way. No. There's no... What you do is entirely of your own creation, of your own... Mm. And then that is out into the world.
Yes.
This is the way you encounter the world. This is for you. Mm. And you're responsible for everything.
Yes.
In that way.
Absolutely. I mean, you've got to love that. I mean, that's one of the things I find attractive. I mean, it brings up its own problems, clearly. And I'm sure what I'm trying to mention. But on the face of it, that I find very attractive. The idea that you don't have prejudgments. Doesn't matter how complex your prejudgments. I mean, Sartre even says, science, religion, and in a sense, I think that they're echoing. He's echoing Nietzsche at this point, and Nietzsche's suspicion about grand narratives. Sartre is saying, look, things like science, religion, ideologies, all of these represent a prejudgment prior to experience. Heidegger says the same thing. He says this is why he said religions are not a philosophy, because he said if you adopt a philosophy or if you adopt a religion or an ideology, whatever it is, then you have already judged. You've already made your decision, in a sense. This is not an exploration anymore. You have decided that this is what existence is and this is what these things are in the world. So Sartre says we need to kind of scrap all that, and we need to kind of think about the actual existences we come across, and then use that, as Husserl said, then use those experiences. So there's still room to create a kind of a science in a way. Use those experiences to create an understanding of essences if we want. He says, the essences can come. We can say this is the core of a thing. And remember Husserl, we said last time we were chatting about this sort of stuff. Husserl says, we want to try and get to the essence of a thing, but we get to it by looking at it for a long time and by doing things with it, and then we understand what it is.
The political aspect of it is exhausting. So if you bring the bad faith into it as well, like let's say you're at a family dinner and someone brings up a political belief they have. And if you're responsible for everything, you have to say something.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's very, I think, obviously, a kind of youthful philosophy. You can imagine people who get, activists who will get very excited about this kind of philosophy.
Yes.
At the moment, in the past, it used to be, about bringing down capitalism. I think it probably still is to a certain extent, but it's all about the environment now, isn't it? That's at least we could, at least let's try and save the environment. So capitalism can continue with an environment to exploit.
Yeah.
So now you'd get students who say, "Well, I can sit at home and do nothing." Or, Sartre would say, "Well, no, it's your responsibility. Otherwise, you're saying this is fine. Yeah, the world we live in. That's you are saying that. If you try to do, I'm not getting involved.
Yes,
I'm not political.
Yes, yeah.
Then you are completely political because you're accepting the world. And that is, I think." Very tiring to try to live as Sartre would say, kind of authentic life.
Yeah. I mean, there's it's one of these things in that where you can see, I can certainly see the attractiveness of it, but you can also see paradoxically, where it could go wrong, or where it could lead you. I mean, bad faith, as you've already mentioned, bad faith is this idea of apathy, the chatter, the they that Heidegger talks about. Sartre says your bad faith is basically, it's not taking. Heidegger says one of the fundamental definitions of human being, of human existence, is freedom. That we are free. He says that this is one of the things that you find as soon as you take into account the fact that you are taking on, you know, taking Heidegger's understanding of thrownness, that you are thrown into a world, everything is up for grabs. There is no preconceived understanding of the world. It's your world. Now, the freedom he says you have is not necessarily the freedom of living without any constraints. You're born into a world, so there are already things in the world which will try and determine who and what you are. So, you know, your physical height, your family background, the country you live in, the kind of political system that's already there. So all those things are there. And Heidegger, Sartre says, well, bad faith is using all those already existing things in the world as an excuse not to make choices. And he says, you can, you know, no matter what, you can make a choice about how you react to all of these things. This is all still up in the air. Okay, you know, you can say, oh, well, you know, I'm a bit short. Now, you know, so now inauthentic or, you know, bad faith would be to say, I'm a bit short, so I can't possibly run a marathon. I can't possibly, you know, do these kind of, you know, athletic things. I can't possibly date taller people. I can't possibly do all of these things. And Sartre says, that's bad faith, because you can. It literally just means you just make the choice to say, you know, okay, I'm sure. What am I going to do about it? Okay, I'm sure. I'm still going to do this. I'm still going to throw my hat in the ring and do this. There's no guarantee that, you know, I will succeed in the traditional sense. But if I don't try, if I don't make a choice in the face of all these things, it just becomes that sort of thing, you know, that as Heidegger's talking about. You just say, oh, well, I can't possibly, because all these things stop me. And he goes so far as to say, you can't even say, as we were saying earlier on, you can't even say, oh, this is my way.
Yeah,
It's not even character and personality. He said, even that is not an essential thing. You know, we say, oh, well, my character is to be a bit shy. My character is to be a little bit aggressive. My character is to be that. He says, no, that is another thing to get you off the hook. You know, you can.
That's
just
why
say
we have the we mentioned before, kind of, and this might be a personal kind of a hope, but when people start talking about psychology and even kind of chemical DNA determining us,
yes,
I hate that. If that's, you know, if that's true, that's very, very bad. And Sartre's on our side here.
He is saying,
well, no. You can't have that. You can't have that saying that that's determining you.
Yes, yeah. And I think there's a real liberation in that. I mean, there are other things I think to talk about here, but there's a real liberation here, because you can say all these things that I'm encountering in the world, and don't get me wrong, I do not practice what I preach. You know, the slightest bump in the road, and that's it. I throw my toys out of the pram, and, you know, that's it. Well, that's it's all over. I can't do it. I can't do this anymore. But Sartre is saying, no, that's bad faith. Anything you encounter, which you think is kind of a pinned down thing in the situated world you live in, you have the freedom to choose how you're going to respond to that. Okay, so, you know, the world is on fire. Okay, so you disagree with the way that the kind of the political elite are, you know, are organising our world. Okay, you don't like this, you don't like that. Okay, well, you know, you can do something about it. He doesn't tell you what to do, and that's the thing. I mean, you know, as far as he's concerned, you know, you could decide to run away to Bora Bora and ignore it and just kind of live out your days kind of living on some kind of beach somewhere. That would be your choice, or you could choose to take up kind of arms against it in some form or another, or some kind of cause, and try and combat against it. But don't use it as an excuse for inactivity. You know, that's that kind of woe is that kind of woe is me sort of, you know, thing. And you find it in Hamlet. So I'll let you get a word in a minute. It's like, you know, Shakespeare's already been there. It's kind of Hamlet kind of going, oh, to be or not to be. I don't know. You know, maybe I should kill Claudius. Maybe I shouldn't. You know, he's sleeping with my mum. He killed my dad. I don't know what to do. The ghost has told me this. I don't. Oh, it's so, you know, and you're all sitting there and Sartre's kind of all like, for God's sake, just make a choice. Just do something. You know, kill your uncle. Don't kill your uncle. Go somewhere else and ignore it all. Give your mother a piece of your mind. Give her a kiss and say goodbye. Do something.
Just stop whining.
Yeah, but you don't stop whining. So the essence, I think the essence of Sartre and existentialism is stop whining. Yeah, well done.